From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Poet Valjina Mort says her native Belarusian is usually described as a language of lullabies, but she called that a myth that seeps into the entire culture.
In fact, there's nothing that's soft about my poetry, or me, for that matter. I'm an angry and aggressive person.
We'll talk about the poetry and language of Eastern Europe this week. But first, Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss North Korea's expansion of its nuclear program and whether it's a threat to U.S. interests, as well as the United Arab Emirates' effort to become the happiest country on Earth.
What does appear clear is this is Emirati happiness. There is no mention that this is going to relate to the immigrant populations there.
The news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, let's start with North Korea this week. North Korea launched a satellite, and there are big concerns here in the United States. The United States intelligence chief, in fact, said that North Korea presents the greatest nuclear security threat to the United States, much more so than Iran. Kind of puts things in perspective there. We've got a deal, nuclear deal with Iran. Of course, don't have a nuclear deal with North Korea. What is going on here? Is this really the greatest threat? What are we going to do about North Korea?
Well, I'm not entirely certain what we're going to do about North Korea, but there is a lot of activity coming out of North Korea of late that does raise a lot of eyebrows and a lot of concern. The nuclear testing in January, the satellite here recently, and then also it appears there are some reports that they have executed one of their top military commanders. And interestingly enough, they are calling a committee Congress in May. This is kind of the Workers' Party getting together to solidify the leader's power over the country. This is the first time that they've done this since 1980. So this is significant. And it also there's indications or evidence that they now have the amount of plutonium that they would need to have a larger scale weapon. So something that we definitely need to keep an eye out. And we keep coming back to this and It's going to be in the front page news going forward. And the new sanctions from Japan, South Korea has drawn back in some of their collaborative projects that have been going on for the last decade or so. So people are taking it seriously.
Well, I was going to ask about the others in the region, obviously South Korea, Japan, other our allies in the region that are terribly concerned about North Korea. But doesn't it come down to this kind of all boils down to, and much in the case of Iran and others like that, this kind of just lack of transparency, lack of understanding. We don't get the North Koreans. We don't understand their leadership. And so it raises those security concerns. So is it so much the weapon, or is it just the weapon in the hands of people that we just don't get, we don't understand, and we don't know how to understand them because they're so closed off. They're not transparent. We can't get to them.
Well, that's absolutely the case. We have allies that have nuclear weapons that we don't have a concern for, that have signed agreements, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and others. We don't understand North Korea, as you said, and we don't even know that the information that we get from them or from South Korea about what's going on there is always accurate. The nuclear testing that went on earlier in January, there's some indication that it was an earthquake, and then we heard it was testing, and then it was an earthquake. And so we simply don't know, and media reports are very vague. And so, yes, it's a concern because we don't know what they're capable of doing were they to have the weapons.
Just worries over uncertainty. Well, let's shift to the Middle East and talk a little bit about the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. They have recently undergone a government reorganization, which is interesting on the one hand that you would reorganize your government. The UAE is not really that old of a country and is full of immigrants. And so they've created these two new ministries, a ministry of happiness and a ministry of tolerance. And so the question is, you know, they're emphasizing these things of happiness and tolerance with specific government agencies. Now, you and I have been to the UAE actually together and recognize that the Emirati population is actually pretty small. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of immigrants and people from around the world, like I mentioned. And so is this the reason why they're doing this? Are they trying to create a more cohesive society? Are they actually concerned about the happiness of their immigrants? And are they going to really be focusing on tolerance of them? Because we witnessed quite a bit to the contrary when we were there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We did see that, saw a number of immigrants from South Asia that were obviously not paid well and heard some stories that were a little disconcerting. But these new positions, the Ministry of Happiness, I think it was so interesting that this was announced via Twitter. That just goes to speak to the age that we live in. It's really unclear what they're going to do. what does appear clear is this is Emirati happiness. There is no mention that this is going to relate to the immigrant populations there. But let's also remember, we've talked a lot about oil prices. This is a country that became big, literally and figuratively, on oil money. We know that they had the tallest building in the world and malls with ski lodges in them and all sorts of other fantastic things. But because the oil situation, you know, perhaps there is an undercurrent of unhappiness. And so this is, you know, a new ministry. We'll see what it's going to be. They haven't really clarified that. And, you know, this isn't the first time that this has been used. In 2013, Venezuela created a similar ministry position, which was seen as a honorary position created to carry on the tradition of Chavez after he passed away, all the many things that he was doing to better people's lives. So maybe it'll be something along those lines. But we didn't see a lot of positive results out of that. Not quite sure what's going to happen here with the UAE and their new Ministry of Happiness.
Well, tall buildings, shopping malls, they do lead to a lot of happiness. We did see quite a bit of happiness there. Adult Disneyland. For
those that had money, we saw a lot of happiness.
For those that had money. All right. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, as always, for being here for Worldviews. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about this discussion, let us know at kgou.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gralat. This show is also available as a weekly podcast through iTunes. Next, I'll talk with Belarusian poet Valjina Mort about her passion for poetry and the power of language. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Today I'm joined by Valjina Mort. She was born in Minsk in the former Soviet Union and moved to the United States in 2005. The New Yorker described her as an envoy for her native country who writes about the struggle to establish an identity for Belarus and its language. Valjina Mort, welcome to Worldviews.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Valjina, as a Belarusian poet living here in the U.S., I'd like to start by just asking you about your interest in poetry. Kind of what developed, what led you down that path to become a poet? You're a very famous poet, well-published poet. What brought you into poetry? How did you develop an interest in that?
I think it was poetry that led me down that path. I grew up in Belarus, in the Soviet Union, and a great myth was that it was a really big reading nation. And I don't know if it was really true in terms of how much reading was done, but it's certainly true that every household had a library, no matter what your parents did, how educated they were. You had a library. There were shelves of books. And so I grew up in a house filled with books, especially by American standards, I'm afraid to say. I grew up in the library. And I read from early on. Books were just part of my life. I played with books along with, I played with dolls, you know. They were just, it was an object that was always a part of my life. And I read indiscriminately prose and poetry. And started writing, as most kids do, you know, trying to put my imagination on paper.
But you've said previously that there's something about poetry and how the words kind of come together, but yet they don't. You have to kind of disentangle them in some ways to kind of make sense of what a poem is telling you, that it's simple. Mm-hmm. Poems are simply written. But then they're not so simply and easily understood. So how is it that that form of writing inspired you?
Yeah, the language of poetry is certainly not the language of the everyday, even though poetry is so much concerned with thinness and with details. It is a different kind of language. Every day we use language in a very utilitarian fashion. We order coffee and we don't want to be brought a tea, a cup of tea. We want to be understood very quickly. But a poem is not concerned with utilitarian aspect of language. It looks at language, I think, as something, it has an anthropological approach to language. It kind of looks for reasons for a table to be called a table, even though you know that it's absolutely arbitrary. And on the other hand, I don't want to overemphasize how much over-worship language is itself, because a poem also is a poem of images and ideas. For me, poetry is always very visual. And what makes poetry language particular? Well, several things. Well, so it's very concise, all right? So instead of using 100 words, you use one word that would work for you. Well, basically like a slave doing the work of 100 other words. Transitions, the leaps that our mind takes, I think it's actually very natural for us to think in these leaps. Poets don't worry much about transitions the way, you know, students have to do them in an essay, for instance. We take leaps, and in those leaps, in those gaps, in the white space on the page, a lot is said with it. Just like a pause in music is just as important as a taken note. Since I mentioned music, the musicality of poetry, when a poem seems to reach to become music, to become just sound, with meaning becoming almost secondary. You know, I don't think that a poet sits down to write a poem because she has, you know, a story to tell, some wisdom to bestow upon the reader. But it's the language that tells the story. And a poet has to listen very carefully to what language can offer. It's the art. Poetry is the art of language, but also art of attentiveness, right, to the human condition, to what's in front of you. And it's up to you how far you're willing to see. You know, a lot of poets do not look beyond a bird chirping outside their window. So to go back to your first question, I studied music as a child, and I thought of becoming a musician. And most of the things that I've learned for poetry, I learned from music. I never studied poetry academically, but just those rules of musical compositions, I transferred them onto language.
So it's something not only you see. I mean, you referred to a poem as being to project a certain image. It's visual, but it's also
oral.
Oral and yeah. Something that you hear. So when you sit down to be creative, to construct, you know, your art form with words, with the language, it reflects something you are seeing, and perhaps not too far outside your window, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, but nonetheless a reflection of something you're seeing and hearing in your mind and you know, about a particular topic, that it's obviously not arbitrary or random, but is it has meaning. And so then how does that relate then to how people receive it and the meaning that they take from your work, from your art form?
Well, I as a poet, I do not worry much about the readers. I trust them to take care of themselves. Of course, all art is very carefully constructed. That's the way for the artist to control the way work is read, whether it's musical work or literary work or visual work. The audience reads this work and throw. So poetry is a very formal linguistic art, and poetic form is a way of controlling the way that the work is read. So it's a poet works not as much with the story as a poet works with the construction, with the form. In fact, right, we live in a very chaotic and fragmented world. And for me, poetry has always been what gave it form. So the formal aspect of poetry is something that I enjoy a lot. The idea of controlling chaos on the page with very carefully orchestrated lines and stanzas.
I'm talking with Belarusian poet Valjina Mort about her approach to her craft. The Poetry Foundation called her an electrifying live reader, and you can watch her recite her poem, Singer, during the 2015 Neustadt Festival of International Literature and Culture at the University of Oklahoma. That video is on our website, kgou.org. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I'm joined by Belarusian poet Valjina Mort. When we left off, she compared the language and creative process of poetry to musical or visual art forms.
So going back to this notion of language, as you're saying, just beautiful and poetic responses that you're providing. But you've written, of course, your poems in both your native language, Belarusian language, as well as English. But it's been said about you that you are trying to reestablish a clear identity for your native country, Belarus, and its language, your native language. And you've referred to it as a soft language, a language of lullabies. And I found this very intriguing because I'm not sure what you mean by soft language and a language of lullabies. Can you tell us more about that and how your work helps us regain or helps you and your country regain its identity in some way through your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I won't know how it does in any way. This kind of things often... they're said by somebody else about me, or during editing of the interview, they're taken out of context and placed as the thing on the page, for instance, or in an audio file. So the idea that Belarusian language is a soft language of lullabies is a myth. That comes drags along with it the myth of Belarusians being calm, peaceful, and tolerant people. You know, it's all a very superficial, artificial construct, and very Soviet construct. This younger Belarusians, Russians, younger brothers and sisters, the calm ones, the tolerant ones, the all-enduring ones with their soft language of lullabies.
Not the domineering.
Yes. Yeah. So of course this is not true, and there's nothing that's soft about my poetry. Or me, for that matter. I'm an angry and aggressive person.
Well, I don't see that.
these are the few taboos in American culture, right? You cannot be aggressive, you cannot be angry, and you also shouldn't judge. I judge, and I'm angry and aggressive. So
poetry is a good outlet for that sort of thing, I suppose.
Well, poetry is my life, you know, so it's not an outlet for me. It's not a career for me. I cannot separate myself from poetry or poetry from myself. I never stop writing. Like all poets, there's not life, you know, some kind of life and then sit down at the table and now create. Once a poet, you're always a poet. That's it. You never stop writing because on the one hand, it's that, as I said, it's the art of language, but on the other hand, it's the art of attentiveness. And you're always alert. You're always attentive to things around you. You know, you're a walking camera, that constantly takes pictures and processes them.
Poetry is also somewhat of a performance art. You say you've known for your live performances, or your poetry readings. I suspect that they're probably quite animated and exciting. And it seems to me that this is kind of a huge movement today in poetry, is public readings and performances of either your own poetry or somebody else's poetry. So tell us a little bit about that and how that relates to perhaps bringing, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of bringing poetry back into kind of popular culture, where, they're very public events now, sharing mm-hmm. one's poetry.
Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I'm very glad that poetry is having that kind of renaissance with these public events. But for me personally, poetry is a very private, a very intimate activity. In fact, just poetry readings in general, I don't find them particularly interesting or engaging. I would much prefer to be at home and to read a book to myself in whisper, because I'm so aware of how boring poetry readings might go, and how every time a poet is reading, I wish I were at home reading these poems to myself. So, yeah, I try to be, not to bore people too much, but I also try not to bore myself, because I wrote these poems, I read them so many times in public, and it gets dull. And then it gets very untrue, dishonest. So when I read the poems, I try to kind of relieve the ecstasy of writing them, in order to not to bore myself and people who came to see me.
It's the ecstasy of writing them. That's a great way of putting it. That yeah. you're taking your own personal experience and bringing it to the public. Well, thank you so much, Valjina, for being with us today and enlightening us a little bit, not only about Belarus, but about your poetry. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Valjina Mort, a Belarusian poet who served as a juror during the 2015 Neustadt Festival of International Literature and Culture at the University of Oklahoma. Worldviews is a collaboration between OU's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski prepares our web content and produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Werlott.